Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm Ethan Elkind. California currently incarcerates 600,000 people. That's five times more than we incarcerated 40 years ago. The cost of this ballooning population in our prisons and jails reflects poorly on our priorities as a state. We spend about $7,500 per student each year, but almost $50,000 per inmate each year, according to census data and the Vera Institute of Justice. Now, statistics like these have fueled efforts to transform California's criminal justice system to make it fairer, cheaper, and less crowded. Our state, which was once a pioneer of tough-on-crime policies, such as the Three Strikes Law, is now pioneering efforts to undo them. Despite a small uptick in crime more recently, legislators are moving ahead with more reforms in 2017, with two bills that would eliminate bail. How much can we liberalize our criminal justice laws before crime rates start rising? Our prison populations are down, but are we saving money? And if we were wrong on the Three Strikes Law, why are we right this time? Tonight, to discuss all of this and more, I'm pleased to be joined by panelists coming at these issues from different sides. So first, I'd like to welcome Will Matthews, Public Affairs Manager for Californians for Safety and Justice. He has held positions at the ACLU in New York and Northern California. Welcome, Will.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
And we're also joined by Steve Wagstaff, President of the California District Attorneys Association and the District Attorney of San Mateo. Welcome, Steve.
Good evening, Ethan.
And we're also joined by Magnus Lostrom, Ph.D., Senior Fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California and co-author of a number of papers for the PPIC on corrections in California. Welcome, Magnus.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And we invite you, our listeners, to join this conversation. We'll be opening up the phone lines in just about 20 minutes, but you can dial 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134 with your questions, or you can email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. And you can also reach us by tweeting us at CityVisionsKALW. Do you think eliminating bail is a safe and just way to address inequity in our criminal justice system? How do you think we should tackle our overcrowded prisons and jails? So let us know your thoughts. So, Magnus, let me start with you. I'd like to get an overview of the different places that people can be incarcerated in California today to kind of lay out the landscape. Are these county jails, federal prisons? Where exactly are people in jail or in prison, and why are they there?
Well, we basically send people convicted of a crime to two different places. We send them to county jail, which is also the place where we house people when they're waiting for trial or when they've been picked up and booked. And that is typically, historically, we've held misdemeanors. So lower-level crimes are the ones who are serving time in a county jail. But we made some changes that there are now you can serve time in county jail for a felony as well. That's a large part of our incarcerated population. It's about 73,000-74,000 on an average day are incarcerated in one of our county jails. The bigger system is the state prison system, where we house about 130,000 inmates on a given day nowadays. And that's where the more serious felons are being incarcerated.
Mm-hmm. And then we also have federal prisons as well?
They're federal prisons. But in general, when we think about incarceration, most people in the U.S. are incarcerated in county jails or state prisons. There's about 2.2 million people incarcerated in the U.S., and about 2 million of those are incarcerated in county jails and state prisons. So federal prisons hold a relatively few inmates, about 10% of the incarcerated population.
And I just mentioned in the opening about this massive ballooning in prison population here in California, but can you give us a sense of what the overall crime statistics have been over the last few decades nationally and here in California?
Right. And they follow pretty much what we see in the U.S. The U.S. trends broadly speaking. What we've seen is steep incline increases in the 70s and in the 80s. Violent crime reached a peak in the early 1990s, but since the 1990s, early 1990s, they've pretty much been coming down steadily. There's some years that with exceptions to it, but we are now at historically speaking, very low crime rates, roughly what you saw in the late 1960s. Property crime rates have been coming down since the early 1980s, and they are roughly at the levels that we saw in the early 1960s. So from a historic perspective, they're low. But we did, as you pointed out, we saw upticks in 2015 And we also saw upticks in 2012. But we should keep in mind that the crime rates have this tendency. They fluctuate from year to year as well. The long-term trend in California is a downward trend.
Mm-hmm. And Magnus, just staying with you, can you give us a sense as to why these individuals are in the prison system? What types of crimes generally are people convicted of and land them in jail?
Well, in state prison, there are nowadays the more serious felons who are being housed there. When you're looking at drug and property offenses, they are now being sanctioned locally. They're going to be serving time in the counties, or they're going to be on probation. So we're talking about the more serious offenders who are serving time predominantly in our state prisons.
Mm-hmm. And Will Matthews, let me turn to you. So we've seen in the last, let's say, five, eight years or so, a general relaxation of our crime laws here. Can you walk us through what some of those developments have been?
Yeah, I think I'd say instead of rather than relaxing, I think what we've done is we've gotten smarter about how to approach public safety and how do we create community safety in all communities around the state. And I think what we've realized is that, the tough on crime era really didn't do a whole lot in terms of addressing the drivers and cycles of crime. We were spending a ton of taxpayer money to lock people up, and we weren't getting a whole lot of bang for our buck because recidivism rates were extraordinarily high. At one point, they approached 70%. The Supreme Court in June 2011 stepped in and said, California, you cannot continue to do this. You are incarcerating so many people that you are creating conditions in the state prison system that are unconstitutional. You've got to get a handle on this. And I think that in a lot of ways that Supreme Court ruling was a wake-up call, and it really forced us to take a look at our failures and really think clearly and thoughtfully about ways to do better. How can we reduce our reliance on incarceration, save taxpayer money, while more effectively addressing the drivers of crime? Instead of just sitting around and waiting for crime to happen and then going after the perpetrator, we need to do a better job of preventing crime from occurring in the first place. And I think the state has done a real good job of doing that over the last several years.
And you mentioned the U.S. Supreme Court decision, but we're also noticing that this is a national trend around criminal justice reform. You're even seeing examples of the Koch brothers and Newt Gingrich kind of advocating now for criminal justice reform. Can you tell us a little bit about why this is, a movement that's happening beyond California and happening nationally as well?
I think this is a bipartisan movement largely because I think that, for a lot of folks, it's become clear that it doesn't make sense to waste the kind of money that we waste every single year locking people up, keeping them in prison for a set amount of time, and then having them come back into the communities, frankly, more likely to commit crime than they were before they were ever incarcerated in the first place. And I think, people from all sides of the political spectrum can realize that there are smarter and more effective ways of approaching criminal justice if we prioritize crime prevention over incarceration. And again, that's something that I think folks from all sides of the political divide can agree on, and I think we're seeing that bear out across the country, not just here in California.
Mm-hmm. And Steve Wagstaff, you're kind of on the front lines of some extent of this as a district attorney in San Mateo. What's your take on the trends of criminal justice reform and at the same time seeing this decrease in crime over the last few decades?
You mentioned earlier, Ethan, 40 years and what's gone on in the 40 years. Well, this year happens to be my 40th year as a district attorney or deputy district attorney and district attorney. And I call this is really our second criminal justice reform. Back in the early 80s is when we started our first, and it went into the 90s. And that was where people were fed up with crime. Crime was out of control. And what we did is we decided not just simply to use a scalpel to try and solve it. We went with a hammer. It's what happened in society. And that's why things like three strikes and the one strike you're out, sexual assault law, and so many of the others came about because people were just fed up and they said, lock them all up. Now, of course, and as was noted, I think it made some sense that, we were provoked into change. This was not philosophy that provoked this change. It was money. And that was that we just simply couldn't afford it anymore, and that we were having people in inhumane conditions in our prison, and that change occurred. When realignment occurred in 2011,
And can you explain realignment?
Yeah, realignment was AB 109, and what it said was, Magnus made a reference to it earlier, it said no longer we're going to have some of these lower-level crimes, are we going to house them in state prison. County jail, you keep them. You have your probation department, probably better able to deal with it than parole officers deal with these men and women, and let's get some programming. And my feeling was at the time that came in, this is a good step. and I totally supported it. And in San Mateo County, where I'm the district attorney, we were well-funded by the state, and we made tremendous inroads on reducing crime, and recidivism dropped dramatically in our county because we were well-funded. Other counties, I was told, wasn't so well-funded. They couldn't do the same sort of treatment, offering the helping hand to people before we just use a hammer on them. So to that extent, I think it's a good step in the reform that we're doing. Compelled by money, who cares what the motivation is if we take some good steps? But it really was a reaction to the lockup times, where it was fear. Fear, absolutely. And I don't know why. I can't tell you why we don't see serial murders in San Mateo County. We're throughout the 80s. I personally prosecuted many of them. We probably had 15, 16 serial murders in a county like San Mateo County, a very suburban county. Whatever the reason, I'm glad it's not there. I'm glad crime is down. There, as Magnus noted, it has its ups and downs, but in terms of that. But overall, we're seeing a general trend in that direction where I don't see what we saw in our county. In my county, throughout the 80s and early 90s, we had 14 people that committed such horrible crimes that my community voted to put them on death row. We've had one since 1994. That's a sign of what's going on in our communities, and it's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really remarkable. And Magnus, what do you think explains this decrease in crime? I mean, from your studies. I mean, I've heard all sorts of theories, you know, for everything from getting rid of lead paint, you know, to the fact that abortion was legalized, and maybe that had an impact. What are your sense?
I think it is. It's difficult to say exactly what's behind it. I think it's fair to say that experts, criminologists, and the people who are studying these trends really don't have enough answers that can truly explain that. The factors that you mentioned are some. There are demographic changes as well, aging population. There are changes in drug markets as well. You know, crack, for example, in the 80s and 90s, early 90s, was a big issue. Much less so. So we have these changes in the drug markets. There are changes in gang activities. There's changes in economic factors as well, and which also has an impact on the swings. So when we see these swings, there are those kind of factors as well that we need to keep in mind that that's going on as well. So one has to be very cautious when you take credit or when you point fingers saying that this is what did that. We have to be very careful, in particular when it comes to crime, because it is not something, crime rate trends, that we have a good understanding of what drives them.
And I would think that as crime goes down, people are more likely to favor criminal justice reforms if they're not feeling that fear on a regular basis. Does that sound correct to you?
Absolutely. I think that's absolutely true. I think it would be difficult to pass these kind of reforms and changes because we have seen big changes in California. We have seen a drop in our incarceration rate over these last 6-7 years by about 30%. Our incarceration rate is now roughly at the level that it was in the early 1990s. So there are these big changes. The prison population has dropped by about 40,000 since it reached a peak in 2006. Big changes. I don't think we would have seen as much of that in an environment where crime was going up. The solution that we came up with, the governor came up with dealing with the federal courts, was telling us to reduce the prison population. At that point in time, we had to reduce the prison population by about 35,000, or we faced this possibility of early release, and that was no climate for an early release. Crimes are coming down, tight fiscal situation. There was no way anyone was going to be talking about expanding the prison system at that time, and we moved towards what Steve explained, realignment. So, yeah, it matters.
And it seems one of the big reforms, at least that in my lifetime that I can remember, was we had the three strikes law, where the third strike and you're in jail for life. And now we've reformed that recently. And Will Matthews, wondering if you could walk the listeners through what that reform was and what the impacts of that reform has been so far.
Yeah, I think Prop 36 really sort of began this trend of criminal justice reform for the state of California. It was the first step that the state took in trying to sort of create a more balanced and a more fair system. There were a lot of people as a result of the three strikes law, who would get a third strike for doing something very, very minor, right? Something nonviolent, something relatively low level, and suddenly they were facing a lifetime in prison. Not only is that unfair and unjust, but it also creates an enormous burden for taxpayers to spend money to incarcerate someone like that for the rest of their life. And so I think Prop 36 really began to enable California to get a handle on the over-incarceration crisis. crisis that has plagued the state for a long time, and it's laid the groundwork, I think, in a lot of ways for some of the subsequent reforms that have come forth.
You heard a lot of sort of horror stories of someone who stole pizza or golf clubs and was in jail for life as a result. And so with Prop 36 now, that has to be a serious or a violent offense.
That's right. That's right.
So, Steve Wagstaff, what's your take on that third strike reform? This Prop 36 passed in 2012, so we have 5 years or so now to kind of assess the impacts of it. What have you seen?
In my county, none. We made that change in the late 90s. Back in 94, March, when the three strikes law passed, we were really approaching that aggressively. Within a few years, we just said, this isn't accomplishing anything. So we basically, our policy, and many other counties, I know Santa Clara County had adopted the same. What Prop 36 did had zero impact on us. But for many of the counties out in the Valley and Southern California, it had a pretty major impact. But I don't think that – I think Prop 36 overall has had no impact on public safety. I think it's been fine. It's worked out fine. And I think it is just a fair outcome from my angle. I actually thought Prop 36 was a reasonable.
So counties could opt out of the state law then?
Well, the DAs. The three strikes law belongs to the DA in the sense of we get to make the decision whether we're going to ask for a three strike sentence or a second strike sentence or a no strike sentence. So that really, depending on which of the 58 DAs you were dealing with and whether they were up for an election or whatever it may be, that motivated them to have their policy.
Mm-hmm. Now, Magnus, let me go back to you on this three strikes issue, because this was controversial at the time, and it's interesting to hear both of these other guests say that basically it's been a positive thing, because we saw an attempt to reform that third strike during the Governor Schwarzenegger administration, and he came out at the last minute against it. And yet, now we're seeing that it passed in 2012, and it sounds like we've got at least here at the table some agreement that has been a positive thing. What have you seen around the politics of this, and is this consensus here among our panel something that you're also seeing statewide?
I think in general that there is pretty wide support for these kind of reforms that do reduce the reliance on incarceration, that reduces the penalties and the sanctions for the various crimes. That has definitely been the case. You saw wide support for Prop 47 that came along in 2014 that reclassified a number of drug and property offenses from felonies or wobblers to misdemeanors. We saw with Prop 57 last year had even wider support, which changes basically the parole process big changes to the prison system as well. So there's wide support here. Prop 36, I think it's fair to say in this context of the reforms that we have seen in California, of those that we have talked about here, basically four, those three plus realignment, it's a smaller one. You have these counties where it had no impact, essentially, because they were already doing it that way. There were a number of other counties where you have seen that. On the prison population, it reduced the prison population by about 2,000 or so. So in a sense, it did have an impact. I have not heard a whole lot of concerns about its impact on crime. The offenders who were being released from prison were typically older and had aged out of criminal activity to a large extent. So we have not heard big concerns about Prop 36.
And what about those groups that were coming out so strongly against it? I mean, can you describe a little bit of those groups kind of politically? What do they represent? Was it prison guards unions and other entities like that? You have a lot of different public safety associations. I'm curious to get into the politics behind that and where they kind of come down on this issue now.
I think in general, when we're moving in this direction of reduction in the reliance on incarceration, typically it is law enforcement are concerned about these changes and feeling like it might take away some of the tools that they have available to them. So law enforcement at times is one group that raises concerns about some of the reforms. Other groups that have raised concerns about moving us in this direction are the prison guards union. It's reducing the prison population, and that could have an impact on number of jobs available to prison guards. And so those are two of the groups that we've seen raised some concerns about it, and the DAs as well have raised some concerns about Prop 47, I think, in particular.
Mm-hmm. Well, it'll be interesting to get into those issues in just a moment, but I want to take a quick break now because my City Visions co-host, who you will all recognize his voice, Joseph Pace, is joining us in the studio. It is Pledge Week here on KALW. So, Joseph, why don't you take it away and tell listeners about the value of their contributions to the station.
Thank you so much, Ethan. What a great conversation so far, and I imagine there's more to come in the rest of this hour. This is New Member Monday here on KALW, and we're asking for your support. If you're a member, become a sustainable member, but if you have never pledged your support, today's the day to do it. There's a new member pack. You can call 1-800-525-9917 or donate at klw.org.
Great. Well, we definitely appreciate your support for this station and for City Visions. We're 25 years on the air now, celebrating our 25th birthday this year. Of course, not all of us in the room can say that, but we're very excited to have your support. Hope you can call in and make that pledge for New Member Monday. That sounds like a great deal.
Yeah, City Visions is locally produced radio that moves the conversation forward and engages listeners to be part of the solution. So why don't you show your support for radio that is engaging and helps to expand dialogue and create understanding? The number to dial again is 1-800-525-9917. You can also go to KALW.org and click there to donate now.
Great. Well, I hope that everyone follows through. Again, that number 1-800-525-9917. This is locally produced radio. We're the talk show that's covering these local issues. It's Monday evening. This is your time to hear about the issues affecting the Bay Area, affecting our state. So again, 1-800-525-9917.
Okay. Back to you, Ethan, and the conversation.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Joseph. So this is City Visions on that local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Our guests tonight are Will Matthews, Public Affairs Manager for Californians for Safety and Justice, Steve Wagstaff, President of the California District Attorneys Association and the District Attorney of San Mateo, and Magnus Lofstrom, Senior Fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California. So we're opening the phone lines now, and we'd love it if you could call in with your questions or comments for the panel. Have you been through the criminal justice system in California? If so, what do you think we need to do to improve it? Or are you concerned about an uptick in crime in our state? The number to call to join the conversation here is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. And you can also reach us on Twitter by using @cityvisionskalw. So, Will Matthews, let me go to you. We talked a bit here about the three strikes reform, but can you talk a bit about Prop 47, which passed in 2014 to reduce drug possession and petty theft crimes to felonies and misdemeanors, and what the impact of that reform has been?
Yeah, so like you said, what Prop 47 did is it reduced the penalty for six discrete crimes, five petty theft-related crimes, so long as it's a petty theft at a value of $950 or less, and then simple drug possession. Those six crimes were reduced from a felony to a misdemeanor. And there are two significant outcomes from that, I think. One is it reduced the number of people that are going into our jails and prisons. Fewer people are being swept into the criminal justice system because of these low-level nonviolent offenses. And that reduction in incarceration has saved the state tens of millions of dollars already. And that is money that is being reallocated to local communities for crime prevention programs, drug treatment, mental health treatment, things like that. Programs proven to really prevent crime from happening before it occurs. The second significant thing that I think about Prop 47 is the fact that it's retroactive. For so long in our country, here in California, across the nation, if you make one mistake, it basically ruins your life. And I think Prop 47 really embraces this idea of second chances, that everyone in this country should get a second chance at life. Just because you make one mistake and get a felony on your record, you shouldn't have to have that hovering over your head for the rest of your life. Folks don't understand that, in the state of California, that when you have a felony on your record, there are nearly 5,000 different restrictions placed upon you here in the state of California. They prevent you from getting jobs, from getting access to education, housing, all sorts of things that you're precluded from just because you've got that felony on your record. Well, after Prop 47 passed, folks who had gotten a felony on their criminal record for one of these six crimes have the opportunity to go back and retroactively reduce that felony to a misdemeanor, enabling folks for the first time to really, re-enter society fully and completely and really get that second chance. And not only, again, is that just, but it also is in the best interest of our public safety to get people back into the community, back with their families, being able to succeed and to uplift themselves. That really helps all of us, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think Prop 47 has not only helped reduce the prison population, it saved money, and it's really giving people a second chance in this mm-hmm. state, and it's all good, from my opinion.
Well, we definitely want to try to talk, if we have time, about what it's like to come out of prison population and what your options are there. But before we get to that, Steve Wagstaff wanted to hear from you specifically on Prop 47, what you've seen, what your take on that reform is, and what are the impacts of reducing those crimes from felonies to misdemeanors.
You know, what Will just mentioned, the noble purpose behind it, is nobody could disagree with that. That's entirely appropriate. What we're concerned about are for those people that don't take advantage of that, the ones who keep coming back again and again and again. That's just only a portion of them. But for them, we can't do anything about it. They just keep committing the same theft offenses, the same whatever it is, drug offenses. They don't want our help when we're offering our helping hand to them. And we just needed a bigger carrot. Hammer to offer them the carrot to get them to change. But I know it's a frustration for prosecutors and police officers throughout California that these people will keep coming back again and again and again. There's just really not much we can do. And for those very much young people who we wanted to sort of provoke into treatment, when misdemeanors are getting just small sentences from judges, or if any sentence at all, we're not giving them any reason to want to change the life. And sometimes people who are drug addicted, they need. The number of times I've been at drug court graduations where somebody thanks the police officer who arrested them, because if that hadn't happened, I wouldn't be here. But instead, these cases tend to be treated like driving on a suspended license, not much attention.
So are you saying that for folks that are going to continuously commit crimes, it doesn't really do them any benefit to reduce the type of the crime down to a misdemeanor? Are you saying it's going to just add to the system that we have to keep processing the crimes, or that there's less incentive for them to try to get off of that cycle?
I'm not so worried about the processing of the crimes, but I am concerned about what do we do to get them off that cycle? You phrased it well, Ethan. How do we motivate them? I don't want to take somebody who's got a drug addict and send them to prison. I have no interest in that. But I do want there to be something that they're going to feel, I need to do something different. Because of those hundreds of ways a felony conviction might affect somebody, maybe some way to do it. It's just those repeat offenders again and again and again, and we feel that they're laughing at the system. There's another aspect of 47 that is totally unpredictable, and apparently on both sides you can come up with the argument to support whether or not it's provoked this uptick that we have and most counties experience in property crimes. Not in violent crime, but in property crimes. It's true in my county we have more residential burglaries, car burglaries, than we've had before, but I am not one of the people who attributes it to 47. But the other side of it is I disagree with the people who say you can't attribute it to 47. I need our experts like Magnus there to continue to study it so they can give us an answer. We don't have the answer, and people who say they do, I don't think it exists now.
Mm-hmm. Ethan, if I could just jump in, one thing I really would like to say is that one of the ways that I think that we can address some of the issues that we're talking about, especially people who are drug addicted, is actually make resources available to help these folks. You'd be surprised to know that 49 out of 58 counties in the state of California, there is not a single residential drug treatment facility. This is not a problem that started with Prop 47. This is a historical failure on the part of the state of California to adequately fund crime prevention programs like drug and mental health treatment. And that's one thing that Prop 47 is starting to do by reallocating the savings that has been generated by Prop 47 directly to community-based crime prevention programs like drug and mental health treatment. We are for the first time creating a treatment and prevention infrastructure that millions of Californians have needed, frankly, for generations. But it's just a start. We need to double down on this kind of investment. This is the direction that we need to be going. That's, I think, one thing that we can certainly do to start helping some of these folks that need it.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly we need to talk about alternatives to these kinds of sentencing and alternatives to the sort of criminal justice status quo that we have. But we're getting an email here from Eric in San Francisco who asks, what states currently lead in criminal justice reform that we should be copying? So, Magnus, why don't I turn that one to you? What do you see as sort of models out there?
I think we are. California is the model. There's no other state that's passing reforms of the magnitude that we're passing here in California. So we're the state that the rest of the country is looking at. I think that's something to keep in mind. I think it also means that we need to learn as much as we can from what we've done here in California, what has worked and what doesn't work, and how we're rolling things out, how we're implementing it. What are those alternatives that we talk about that really do work? Those are lessons that are important for the state of California, for public safety here, for our ability to reduce recidivism rates, reoffending, and also lessons for the rest of the country as they move forward. No other state has done what California has done in the last 6 years.
So this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at kalw.org. Our guests tonight are Will Matthews, Public Affairs Manager for Californians for Safety and Justice, Steve Wagstaff, President of the California District Attorneys Association and the District Attorney of San Mateo, and Magnus Lofstrom, Senior Fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California. We'd love to hear your questions or comments. A number to call to join this conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or if you're too shy to call or you'd rather email or text, you can do so at cityvisions@kalw.org. You can also post a comment on our website, kalw.org, or on our Facebook page. You can also reach us on Twitter by using @cityvisionskalw. So we'd love to hear your questions and comments for the panel. So Magnus, I wanted to go back to you, and you just mentioned that we're a leader in terms of criminal justice reform, but we're also apparently a leader in prison overcrowding. And wondering, has the Supreme Court told other states to reduce their prison populations the way they've told California to do so?
Well, I think that, you know, there's a concern in a number of other states that they will end up in the position that California was in going back to 2009 when a three-judge panel told us that we had to reduce the prison population dramatically. It was upheld by the Supreme Court. So other states are learning from that kind of experience and concerned about that. There are also counties here in California that are facing court-ordered population caps, meaning that they have to be concerned they can't actually have a population over a certain level. And if they reach that particular level, they have to move on to early releases, capacity-constrained releases. So they're definitely, you know, there are concerns that one would be put in the position where you're facing the possibility that a federal court will tell you exactly what to do. So that's certainly something that people have been looking and trying to prevent in other states.
Yeah, I'm sure other states don't want to be in a situation like ours here. I want to go now to current reforms. You talked about a few of the past reforms, the three strikes reform and the Prop 47 reform. But there's currently proposals in the legislature right now to eliminate bail. A lot of the proponents argue that this is an equity issue. And Will Matthews, I wanted to ask you if you could explain for listeners what these proposals are about, what's motivating them, and what it would mean to eliminate bail.
Yeah, you know, I think some of the bail reform legislation that is moving its way through Sacramento right now is just the latest in this trend that we're seeing in California, and it fits into this overall theme of can we more effectively and cost effectively, create safety in our communities? And I think, you know, when looking at the bail system, the money bail system, as it's been in California for decades now, you look at it and it really doesn't make a whole lot of sense that someone who is rich and is booked into jail and is awaiting trial can bail themselves out, buy themselves out of jail, for example, regardless of how serious the charge that person may be facing. But someone who has less means and is facing a much less serious charge has to remain in jail for days, weeks, even months, putting their employment at jeopardy, eroding ties with the community, things like that. That just doesn't make any sense. It's not in the best interest of public safety. I look at Steve right now, and he was telling a story before the show started about a woman in his county, in San Mateo County, facing a murder charge. Bail was set, I think, in her case at $35 million, if I'm remembering that right, and she was able to come up with $70 million, a lot of it in property, and was able to get out of jail while she awaits trial. That's that's someone facing a murder charge. I'm guessing that in the same jail facility in San Mateo County, there is someone facing a significantly lesser charge who just doesn't have, let's say the second person's bail set at, I think the state average is around $50,000. So let's just say that the bail set at $50,000. You either come up with $50,000 or you come up with 10% of that and you're able to bond yourself out. But even for a lot of folks, $5,000 can be very prohibitive. So someone facing a much lesser charge than murder has to stay behind bars, wallow behind bars, where someone accused of murder but just happens to have a lot of money can be free. That doesn't make any sense in terms of justice, and it certainly doesn't make any sense in terms of public safety. And I think that's what we're looking to do in California by reforming the money bail system. Bring some equity back into the system, but also bring some common sense back into the system so that we actually are doing what is in the best interest of public safety.
So what would you propose to see instead? I mean, I assume that most people are probably uncomfortable with having someone accused of murder, being able to easily walk free. So how do we sort of guard against those public safety concerns but still have an equitable system?
Yeah, I think we need to shift the system from one that's based on money and to one that's based on risk. And there are validated tools that are out there that are being used in states around the country that can successfully analyze and predict the risk of someone committing another crime while they're out awaiting trial what their risk is to flee and not show up to court. There are counties around the state of California, in fact, Santa Clara County being one of them, that is really on the leading edge of using risk as the determinative factor for whether or not someone stays behind bars while they await trial or whether they're able to be back in the community. And Santa Clara County, I think they're, 90-something percent of the folks in their pretrial program who are released prior to their trial are, in fact, showing up for court without committing a new crime in that interim period. So I think that county really shows that bail reform can work effectively, and it's something that I think the rest of the state really needs to follow the lead on. So,
and I should point out for listeners that the two bills are SB 10, Senate Bill 10, and AB Assembly Bill 42. Steve Wagstaff, what's your position on these bail reform bills, and maybe more generally, what's the position of the California District Attorneys Association if they have one on these two bills?
We do. We have studied them and taken a position of opposition. We don't believe these two bills are the answer. Will and I are going to agree. Again, this is turning into a love fest for us, but the reality is I think there ought to be bail reform too. I've been watching it for decades. I agree there needs to be bail reform. These two bills don't accomplish that end. They serve a particular end. In my mind, they take away judicial discretion. I still believe in judges. I still believe in, even though there are many decisions I don't agree with, but overall, I believe in judges having discretion. This takes away a lot of that discretion. It imposes, basically, lets all the lower level people out, no matter what they're going to be released. I still believe judges ought to have the discretion. But I agree very much with Will and the Chief Justice of California that there needs to be reform. I'm concerned the top end. I do have that defendant in my charge with murder who is now in her home tonight, probably watching the Warriors, having a $35 million bail posted. It's actually 62, almost 66 total. That's not right. And that's simply not right. And that's why what I have been suggesting to DAs around the state in my organization, and many are agreeing with me, we need to take a hard look at whether there ought to be a money bail system at all. Mm-hmm. And that means at any level. That means that because what these two bills do is they're going to help the people who are there on the 5,000 and who are could be victimized by bail agents because that old 10% rule is not there. A lot of times they'll take a credit card and it's really predatory. It's almost predatory lending and insuring. And I would rather see – I seriously think we ought to consider the way we deal with juveniles. There's no money bail in our juvenile court system. It's either detain or don't detain within rules. And that's why the risk assessment that's being referred to, yes, I think that's a good system to use. But I would rather keep discretion in judges, and I wouldn't let money, whether you're rich or you're poor, play the role on whether you're released.
So it sounds like you two are in agreement on the eliminating the money issue. Maybe the disagreement here then is the discretion given to the judges. Is that correct?
For me, it's these two bills really take away too much discretion from the judge and put too high a burden for the judge where they can set money bail if that's chosen. The standards are too high to impose the level of security that a judge can make the decision. The other part that isn't mentioned, and I've heard a variety of numbers last Friday, that this These two bills would cost, I think the proponents say, I heard $500 million, and I heard the opponents are saying it could be $1 to $3 billion. Again, I don't know. I turn to experts for that. But that type of a cost, I think, makes it a non-starter for what we have here. Whereas if we do consider going to a no-money bail system, well, that's just get the risk assessment in there. That, and I think that possibly, it's certainly worthy of study. The whole issue needs study, and I greatly support change. And I think my organization does, too.
That's interesting to hear. Well, I want to welcome back in Joseph Pache. You've got double vision on City Visions because you've got the two hosts from City Visions in the same studio. This is at least exciting for me, if not for anyone else.
So,
Joseph, since it is Pledge Week, what's the latest for listeners?
Well, we have a challenge here from listeners in our producer circle, and that's Guy and Janine Saperstein in Piedmont, are putting up $250 to match any donations up to $250 in this hour of City Visions. So if you'd like to double your money, as it were, call 1-800-525-9917, or you can click on klw.org. Either one counts. And it's New Member Monday, so if you haven't had a chance to yet show your support financially for KLW, now's the time.
So I think if you're doubling your hosts for City Vision, you should definitely donate now when you can double the impact of your gift, and that's by calling 1-800-525-9917. But that seems like a perfect opportunity. If you haven't given before, this is your chance. You get double the bang. So I think this is fortuitous.
Be informed, be engaged, be part of the community that supports this special kind of locally produced radio that has been coming to you for over 75 years, and 25 of them City Visions. The number to dial again is 1-800-525-9917. Did you know, Ethan, that only 1% of our budget here comes from corporate underwriting? There's not many places on the dial that can say that.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, we truly are a station of the people. I mean, we would not be able to do what we do without the support of listeners like you tuning in. You know, as Joseph, as you just said, you know, we don't have that same corporate support, and I think that's a positive for the station. We can do the kind of programming that we want to do. We don't have those commercial breaks. It's just the Pledge Week that we ask you to show your affection for the programming and to give an opportunity to continue this programming and to talk about these local issues. 1-800-525-9917.
There's $250. On the table. Don't leave it on the table. Now is the time to call to double your money thanks to the generosity of Guy and Janine Saperstein in Piedmont. Once again, 1-800-525-9917, klw.org, and now back to City Visions.
All right. Thank you, Joseph. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at kalw.org. Our guest tonight, Will Matthews from the Californians for Safety and Justice, Steve Wagstaff, District Attorney of San Mateo, and Magnus Lofstrom, senior fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California. We're talking criminal justice reform. We'd love to hear your questions or comments. The number to call to join the conversation, not to be confused with the number to pledge, which we also want you to dial, but the number to call in and ask questions here is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on klw.org or on our Facebook page. And you can also reach us on Twitter by using @cityvisionsKALW. Magnus Lofstrom, let me go back to you on this question of bail reform that we've been talking about just before we went to break right there. Are there other states that we could be learning from when it comes to bail reform?
I think that there are definitely other states that we can learn from, and you can look at Washington, D.C., for example, where, you know, being detained in jail awaiting trial is rare. It's the minority. I think it's about 15% of their cases that are actually staying in jail. So there are other states that are doing that. I think, you know, one thing, and it's been pointed out by Will here too, that there are counties in California that are trying out these risk assessment tools, where the reforms that we're talking about today would take us to. It is implementing a risk assessment tool as opposed to bail. So I think it's because now we're talking about an environment that we are in here. So if we can learn, if we can look at these counties in California that have tried risk assessment tools, alternatives to deciding on pretrial detention or not, that's probably the most valuable place for us. I also think it's, you know, it's important to keep in mind that when we're talking about the incarcerated population, the jails, this is where you would be incarcerated if you're awaiting trial. That's about two-thirds of the jail population is pre-trial. So that's – if we want to – jails are facing challenges in California as well with these reforms. There are new responsibilities for the county jails that they're facing. So if there are ways to address those kind of capacity issues that the county jails are facing, that's something that we ought to take a look at. We also know when we look at our offenders here in California and their failure to appear or committing a crime while they're awaiting trial and have been out on bail, we haven't been particularly successful. We have had higher failure to appear rates than the country as a whole, and we had more reoffending, at least in terms of nonviolent crime in California, than the rest of the country. So taking a look at what we're doing and look for alternatives seems to be a reasonable thing. What specific solution we should implement, it's hard to tell. These risk assessment tools is definitely a good place to start and then see what works best in the various environments that we're dealing with.
And based on what we heard, there may be some common ground on some of those, looking at some of those tools. I want to go to the phone lines. We have Matt from San Francisco. Matt, welcome to City Visions.
Thank you very much. My question is for the District Attorney of San Mateo. Not that I know that much about San Mateo County, even though I grew up there, in terms of investigation. But since you represent DAs across the state, I have a real concern about, there have been a lot of, across the nation and in San Francisco, in California, there have been a lot of killings of young men by police. And I'm not satisfied in general with how the relationship between the DAs and the police, since they have to work together. I think a lot of the public is not satisfied with investigations into police shootings, especially when the stuff's on videotape. And to the majority of the public, it just seems like the people should not have been shot and the police were not justified. Can you speak to that, the public's perception of a conflict of interest and poor investigation on the part of the DAs and lack of prosecution and bringing charges to cops who kill people, please?
So, Steve, not necessarily exactly on the topic of criminal justice reform, but I think it does go to the dynamics between law enforcement and district attorneys. Do you want to respond to Matt's question there?
Yes, Matt. No, Matt, I had that very discussion this afternoon with a family of a fellow who was – he wasn't shot, but while he was being arrested by the police, he died of medical reasons. And they pointed the same thing out to me. And my comment to them was, I understand the concern because we do work with law enforcement. However, law enforcement doesn't work for me. They don't do what I want. If I had my choice, every law enforcement officer in this nation would be wearing a body cam because it is phenomenal what that provides. And I think we're going to get there. We're not there yet. But the concept was introduced in our legislature that what they ought to do is have the Attorney General do all investigations all over the state of California. That was both the Attorney General, now Senator Harris, and every law enforcement completely opposed that, just simply the magnitude of trying to do it. So unless we want to spend millions to set up an independent investigative agency, I don't see how that would work. In the meantime, I do believe that district attorneys do, at least in our county, how we do it and many do it, is completely independent. We're not doing it in conjunction with law enforcement. We do the investigation, we interview the witnesses, and we arrive at our decision. Right now, I think that's as independent as can be, and not all counties are like that. There are some counties where the DA has nothing to do with the investigation. It's being done by a fellow police agency nearby. So there's proposals out there. I think, in my experience, I find what works now is the best.
All right. Well, thank you, Matt, for that question. I want to go to a slightly different issue, but one that you, Will Matthews, had raised around what it's like when people are coming out of prison and they often have difficulty finding jobs, can't vote, et cetera. What do you see as a sort of disincentives there to help them become responsible citizens, and what could be done to address that challenge?
Yeah, I just had the opportunity to sit down and have lunch recently with a woman who recently got into senior housing in Berkeley. And, you know, she was a woman whose father was murdered when she was a kid growing up. So that was a trauma that she, you know, dealt with in various ways, you know, growing up through her life. She ended up struggling with drug addiction during a period in her life. And it was a period of time where she, you know, got a couple of felony convictions for drug possession as a result of the addiction that she was struggling with. And she was just, because of Prop 47, able to reduce some of those felony convictions on her record to misdemeanors. And she was able to get herself eligible for senior housing, and she now has the peace of mind to be in senior housing. And that's a great success story that we're seeing replicated all across the country. People for the first time are being able to get out from underneath the mistakes of their past and really you know, live their lives fully again. And you really can't put a price on that, I don't think. And that's something that's really, really important, I think, about some of these reforms that have been undertaken in California in recent years, and that is that it's really given people a second chance at life. And that's just an incredible phenomenon that we really are doing here.
So this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco. We welcome your questions and calls. We've got just about 7 or 8 minutes to go here, but the number to call if you want to bring in any last-minute questions is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I wanted to move in our closing minutes here to the subject of prevention. And Magnus Lostrom from the Public Policy Institute of California wanted to ask you what you see in your research as some of the promising types of things that public officials can do to prevent criminal activity in the first place.
Well, you know, we've talked about reducing our reliance on incarceration and looking at alternative strategies. What is it that we can do? And you're bringing up then what is it that we should really try to do more of? And research points towards, you know, a number of things that we can do. And we're on the path of doing some of those things already. One, and I think you need to have a wide perspective on this. You need to have a short-term and long-term perspective as we're implementing these reforms. The reforms have the potential to have an immediate negative impact on public safety. So once you're reducing the reliance on incarceration, there should be something in place that actually addresses that from the get-go. One alternative that you know, research is pointing out is effective in terms of both deterring and that preventing crime in a cost-effective way is actually adding more polices. More police on the street is something that is cost-effective, much more cost-effective in incarceration as well. And in California, we've seen a reduction in number of law enforcement officers in California since the Great Recession, and it's a drop of about 10% if we measure it on a per capita basis. So that's something that we should keep in mind as we're moving forward as well. There are challenges when it comes to that as well. There are strained relationships between law enforcement and communities. There's challenges in recruitment and finding the right kind of people as well. So I recognize that too. Then there is the population that's already in the criminal justice system, and some of the promising approaches is cognitive behavioral therapy that has been shown to be successful as well. So we can look at that particular population, and there's certain, you know, what things that work. Substance abuse programming and treatment is also something to look at. I also think we need to have a very long-term perspective here, and that's thinking about youth, at-risk youth. What are the things that we can do to prevent young individuals from even entering into the criminal justice system? Because once you're in there, it's hard to get out. So investment in that particular, those kind of endeavors are very, very important.
And Steve Wagstaff, wanted to also throw you a similar question around not just prevention, but kind of what you would like to see ideally put in place from a policy perspective when it comes to criminal justice, the criminal justice system in California.
Every single word that Magnus just said, it's nodding my head the whole time. Those are great things. And I'm seeing it actually work. I'm actually involved in organizations that are helping kids, getting them early. Education. What is the number? I heard this. I hope it's not true, but that of the state prison population, upwards of 4/5 of the people in there didn't graduate high school. I can't imagine that being accurate. And if it is, it tells me. Education. Be involved there. And then there's another segment of our society that we haven't mentioned at all tonight, and yet we need to take and invest our resources there, and that's helping the mentally ill. The county jails and the prisons are the number one mental health facilities. We haven't opened a state hospital in decades, and I just know we need to. We've got to do more to help the mentally ill. We don't want them in jail. We've started a program in San Mateo County. It's small, but to divert them, people with mental illnesses on low-level offenses, get them out of the jail. We don't want them there. And that, to me, is also something that has to be addressed in criminal justice. I voiced that to Governor Brown. You know, don't build any more prisons. Build more mental health facilities so that we can try and help people in our society.
And you know, one issue we haven't really talked about is the victims of crimes and where they are, where they stand on some of these reform proposals. And I would imagine, as you know, district attorney, you're in touch with those victims' families and the victims themselves. What do you have a sense of kind of where they generally tend to fall on these proposals?
A fear that they're forgotten. A fear that they don't matter. A fear that, you know, all the things to help the offender and how's it going to help them and what they've gone through. And so what we pushed after Prop 57 passed, the DA's Association, we met with the governor, and his staff did agree that we can get notice so our victims can know exactly when these procedures are going, voice whatever opinion they want, so they don't learn that their offender is back on the street the first time they see him on the street. And so it's you're right. Victims need assistance there. It can't be forgotten.
Mm-hmm. Ethan, you bring up the question of crime victim survivors, and I think it's actually really important. You know, one thing that is important is that we not just assume that we know what it is that crime victim survivors want. We did polling both across the state of California and nationally that actually revealed that crime victim survivors favor policies that take money away from incarceration and invest that money in crime prevention programs. Because it makes sense, right? What's the best way to avoid crime victims being created in the first place? That's to prevent crime from happening in the first place. They recognize that. And you know, I don't think it's a little bit counterintuitive from what we've understood, you know, popularly. But crime victim survivors in the state of California favor the kinds of reforms that we're talking about for that exact reason. They recognize that that's the most effective way of ensuring that we don't create new crime victims moving forward.
And Will Matthews, staying with you, what do you see as the sort of next frontier in criminal justice reform? I mean, let's say something happens with this bail reform legislation. What do you think we could also see coming up on the horizon?
Well, you know, you talked about, you know, ways to address the needs of some of the folks that are out there. There's a program being pioneered in Seattle, King County, in the state of Washington. Money has been made available to the city of San Francisco, actually in the county of San Francisco, and Los Angeles County. It's called Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion, and it's very similar, I think, to what Steve was just talking about, where folks who are you know, either drug addicted or dealing with mental illness are actually diverted away from the system and put into a treatment program that if they successfully complete, then they won't end up being prosecuted. They'll never make it into the system in the first place. I think that's a great example of the kinds of programs that we really need to be looking at and investing in here in California. It's been effective in Seattle. It can be effective here.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there. That's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight are Will Matthews, Public Affairs Manager for Californians for Safety and Justice. Thank you for coming on. And also Steve Wagstaff, President of the California District Attorneys Association and the District Attorney of San Mateo. Glad you were able to join us. And Magnus Lofstrom, Senior Fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California. Thank you as well. And thanks to all of you for listening in as well. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was David La Tulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. Join us next week as we interview author and photographer Tabitha Soren, whose book Fantasy Life tells the photographic story of a group of minor league draft picks for the Oakland A's made famous by the book Moneyball. This is Ethan Elkind. Thanks so much for listening. Good night and have a great rest of your week.
On this new member Monday.